Okay, so I'm going to talk about adaptive algebraic multi-grid methods and basically show that they're suitable for handling some of the difficulties that arise in linear systems in lattice QCD. I'll mainly focus on the adaptive algebraic method and won't discuss the physics much because I don't have a background in the physics. So let me just acknowledge some of the organizations that have funded this work, essentially the Department of Energy, National Science Foundation, and the Center for Applied and Scientific Computing at the Lawrence Livermore National Labs. And here's a list of the collaborators, which I won't mention individually, but just note that we have a formidable group working on this currently. So give an overview of my talk. I'll start with some background and motivation. Essentially, I'll discuss the linear iterations that are related to multigrid. I'll give a review of basic multigrid principles. Then I'll discuss the two main multigrid approaches, essentially the geometric multigrid approach and the algebraic multigrid approach. Then I'll give a recently developed extension of these, of the algebraic multigrid approaches, namely the adaptive approaches, in the setting of two of the more well-known methods in this field, which are essentially the classical algebraic multigrid algorithm and then the smooth aggregation algebraic multigrid algorithm. And then as a specific application, I'll talk about the two-dimensional Hermitian-Dirac-Wilson formulation. This is a formulation that was originally presented to us from Claudio Rebbi, a colleague of Rich's at Boston University. And I'll give some numerical results that demonstrate that such an adaptive approach can appropriately handle the linear systems arising in lattice QCD. And finally, I'll give some concluding remarks. So to start with, let me just motivate the need for optimal linear solvers. We're interested in simulating complex physical systems with features and hence solutions that vary on multiple scales. And often in such simulations, the main task is to solve the linear system of equations AX equals B. And for this talk, I'll assume that A is large, sparse, and symmetric positive definite. In the context of PDEs, accuracy constraints lead to systems with billions of degrees of freedom. For example, the equations, the transport equations. And in QCD, hybrid Monte Carlo requires repeatedly solving systems involving the Dirac operator. So without an optimal linear method, such simulations are prohibitively expensive. And what I'll talk about essentially are multigrid methods, which have been shown to be optimal in terms of both complexity and storage for a wide range of problems. So again, the two main linear iterative methods that are associated with multigrid are stationary iterations, which choose approximations to the inverse of the given matrix and iterate using the following error equation. Here I've written this in the form of a residual update. Essentially, for the Jacobi iteration, we choose M to be the diagonal of the matrix A. For Gauss-Seidel, we choose M to be the lower triangular part. And for SOR, we choose M to be some parameter omega times the lower triangular part, where omega is selected to minimize here the spectral radius of the error propagation matrix. Then there are Krylov methods, which iterate by finding the optimal approximation to the solution in a given subspace, namely the Krylov subspace, which I've defined here. And these methods iteratively increase the size of the subspace to improve accuracy. And I'll just note that these are non-stationary methods. So we have in mind that we'll be using multigrid methods as a preconditioner for these types of iterations. So this slide here that I've included, or this diagram, just illustrates that such classical iterations do not suffice for the types of problems that we have in mind. The bottom line here in black represents the number of estimated floating point operations to solve the problem. And of course, here I mean solve the problem. By solving the problem, I mean reaching discretization error. And what we'll note is that none of these methods reach the optimal, are optimal. And so what I'll present is a multigrid algorithm, which is optimal in a sense of complexity and storage as well. So there are a few basic multigrid principles that I just wanted to review that lead to the overall resulting algorithm, and the first is smoothing. And so, although we know that Jacobian Gauss Seidel iterations converge for linear systems arising from discretizations of PDEs, they require order n to the 5/3 operations for three-dimensional problems, where n here is the number of degrees of freedom or unknowns. However, some of these components are resolved much faster than others, and this is depicted here by the figures below, where if we're solving the Laplacian in two dimensions and we start with some random initial guess, so we have a random initial error that has the following characteristics. And what we see is after only 5 Gauss Seidel relaxations that the error is really geometrically smooth. And for this reason, we call Jacobian Gauss Seidel iterations smoothers. That is, they smooth the error in the current approximation. And this is, again, the first main observation behind multigrid algorithms. The second is that we can complement relaxation by using fewer degrees of freedom. Essentially, since the error left from relaxation is geometrically smooth, we can represent it using fewer degrees of freedom, which is what I've done here in the diagram below, by doubling the grid spacing in each spatial dimension. And so by using fewer degrees of freedom, we can solve for this smooth error with less computational effort. Moreover, what we'll notice is that error that appears smooth on the fine level or with more degrees of freedom appears oscillatory when represented using fewer degrees of freedom. And so we can apply recursion. And what I mean here is that we can now again apply relaxation to this oscillatory error on the coarser level in order to smooth it out and then represent the remaining error using even fewer degrees of freedom. And that's essentially the basic idea behind multigrid algorithms. So these observations lead to the following basic algorithm, which consists of L levels. And essentially, I've defined it here recursively. Again, we begin by applying nu1 pre-smoothings to the system of equations, which results in a smooth error. And so we can correct, or we can compute the correction for this approximation on a coarser grid using fewer degrees of freedom. So what we do is we form the right-hand side of the error equation by forming the residual and then using some restriction operator to restrict it to the coarser level. Then we solve this error equation on the coarser level, either directly, if we're at the coarsest level and a direct solve is cheap, or recursively by gamma applications of the multigrid algorithm, which is defined here. And one thing I'll note here is that gamma is referred to a cycle index. So for gamma equals 1, we get the well-known V cycle. And for gamma equals 2, we get, for instance, W cycles, where we do additional work on coarser levels. Once we have, once we've solved for the error on the coarser level, what we do then is we interpolate that error to the fine level, and then we compute the correction. Finally, we apply nu2 post-smoothings to remove any oscillatory error that may have been introduced by the coarse grid correction. And so what I've highlighted here in red are the components that need to be defined in order for such an algorithm. Essentially, we need the smoothers for every level. We also need the matrices on every level. We need the restriction operators and the prolongation operators. And it's these components that distinguish the various multigrid algorithms. So for the remainder of this talk, what I'll discuss is essentially how one constructs these algorithms, or these components. Sorry. So I'll begin with geometric multigrid. In geometric multigrid, these components are essentially tailored for the problem at hand. That is, if the initial fine-level problem is defined on a geometrically regular grid, then coarse grids can easily be selected, which is demonstrated in the figure here below, where we just double the grid size in each spatial direction as we go from one level to the next. Also, using tools such as local Fourier analysis due to Aki-Bront, smoothers can be designed so that the error not reduced by relaxation is geometrically smooth. So for instance, for anisotropic diffusion, we would use something like a line smoother in order to generate geometrically smooth errors after relaxation. Since the functions after relaxation are geometrically smooth, we can use a trivial interpolation to accurately represent them. For example, we can use linear, bilinear, or trilinear averaging for the cases of 1, 2, and 3 dimensions, respectively. And the restriction operators can be defined by injection or as the transpose of interpolation. Finally, the coarse grid equations can be defined by rediscretizing the problem on the coarser level. Okay, so in the absence of algebraic or geometric information, i.e., we're only given the system of equations and the matrix A, the components for the hierarchy of coarse problems have to be constructed in a setup phase. This adds to the complexity of the algorithm. However, there's always a trade-off between complexity and robustness of the algorithm. Essentially, motivated by the success of multigrid methods, algebraic versions were proposed in the early 80s by Aki Brandt, Steve McCormick, John Ruge, and Klaus Steuben. The original algorithms were developed for M matrices only, essentially elliptic problems on unstructured grids with rough coefficients. And here, algebraic stands for the fact that the tools or components of the method are constructed solely on the basis of the algebraic information given in the original matrix.
So, what does rough coefficients mean?
Discontinuous coefficients, so jumps in the coefficients in the grid. So, okay.
But generally, not changes in sign, so the thing still is.
Right. Yeah, but just large jumps. And so, in algebraic methods, we adopt geometric language, that is, we speak of fine and coarse grids, or more generally, fine and coarse degrees of freedom, as well as interpolation and restriction operators. And typically, we'll assume that restriction is defined as the transpose of interpolation, and that the coarse level matrices are variationally defined, as follows here. This can be justified theoretically, essentially, by using this form, we can show that the correction is optimal over all possible corrections for any given interpolation operator. So if we assume that the restriction is the transpose of interpolation and that we define the coarse level operators in this way, then the remaining task is to construct the interpolation operator, which essentially involves the selection of the actual coarse degrees of freedom, which give rise to the columns of the interpolation operator, the selection of the sparsity pattern of the interpolation operator, and the actual entries. Before I describe various methods, algebraic methods for defining these interpolation operators, I just want to give a theorem that's used in motivating the choices we'll make. Essentially here, we consider TG to be the two-grid error propagation matrix for a two-level method, where pi here is just an a-orthogonal projection onto the range of interpolation. And if we assume that the following weak approximation property holds, along with this stability condition, then we can show, essentially, that the two-grid method converges in the a-norm. Here, this constant's greater than or equal to 1, and of course what we'd like is to have this constant as small as possible so that convergence is as good as we can get it. This approximation property here tells us basically that if x is an eigenvector corresponding to a small eigenvalue, then interpolation has to be very accurate, and that's the reason we've included the a-norm here. And the stability condition essentially tells us that we should choose as an interpolation operator the eigenvectors of the matrix A. And so these two properties need to be satisfied in order to get a robust method. So what we'd like to do is, we don't really want to choose the eigenvectors because this leads to a dense interpolation matrix and therefore a dense coarse grid operator, since we're using the variational form. So what we'd like to do is find some sparse approximation or some sparse interpolation operator whose span approximates the error that's left over from relaxation. And that's the goal in designing all of these interpolation operators. And this theorem was originally proved by Brombo, Patrick, Wang, and Chu in 91. I should note, too, that if these constants are bounded for interpolation operators for a multi-level algorithm, that is, on every level, then this theorem extends to a multi-grid algorithm, and we can show similar convergence results. Okay, so now I'll talk about classical algebraic multi-grid. And of course, the first thing we have to do is select the coarse degrees of freedom. And in the classical approach, the coarse grid is defined as a subset of the fine grid, and one seeks a partitioning of the fine-level degrees of freedom, or the fine grid, such that there exists an interpolation operator which has the following form so that satisfies the weak approximation property. And what I should note here is that due to this choice, or this form of the error component that we're considering, actually the approximation property is satisfied exactly on the coarse degrees of freedom. So to select the coarse degrees of freedom, we use an independent set algorithm which uses the graph of the matrix and the so-called notion of strength of connections, which is defined as follows. We say that variable I strongly depends on variable J if the jth entry in the ith row of the matrix is comparable in magnitude to the largest off-diagonal entry in the ith row. And typically, we take theta here to be something like 0.25. The following result is easy to show for M matrices. Essentially, it says that for smooth error, that is, vectors having small residuals, this smooth error varies slowly in the direction of strong connections. And this can be seen in the following way. Here, AII is positive because we're considering an M matrix, and these values, well, the ratio of these values is bounded away from zero. So for this to be much less than one, these two values have to be similar, which again tells us that smooth error varies slowly in the direction of strong connection. And so the problem is coarsened in the direction of strong connections for classical AMG. Modern tools for this task rely on the so-called compatible relaxation algorithm, which is also originated by Aki Brandt. And some other references essentially are some papers that I'm in the process of writing. Actually, this is the main topic of my thesis. I won't discuss this in detail because my experiments have shown so far that standard coarsening is appropriate for lattice QCD type problems, and so there's no need for a more advanced type of coarsening strategy for these problems. So given the coarse grid, we have to select the sparsity pattern, and essentially we choose the interpolation to have the following form. So all that we need to do here is select the sparsity pattern of W, which make up the weights for basically, or the averages for obtaining the error at the fine degrees of freedom based on the error computed on the coarse grid in the coarse grid correction. These are also based on the aforementioned notion of strength of connection, and the sparsity pattern is typically limited to nearest neighbors, again defined by the sparsity graph of the matrix. What we do essentially is for the ith neighborhood, which I denote here by N sub I, we partition it into two sets. C sub I, which are the coarse points in this neighborhood, and then the complementary set, which is F sub I. Once we have the non-zero sparsity pattern, we select the non-zero values. And we define the weights in W for the averages. And in effect, the way this is done is the error at the F points is represented as a linear combination of the values at the C points as follows. And that's given by this formula here. So given that the coarse grid representation of the error is just the restriction of the fine level error to the coarse degrees of freedom or to the coarse grid, if we're seeking the ith row of interpolation, we just substitute this expression here into the ansatz that for algebraically smooth error, we have small residuals. And this defines the ith row of the interpolation or of the matrix W in the interpolation operator. Now, since for M matrices, smooth error varies slowly in the direction of strong connections, the entries of W are usually selected to preserve constants locally. And this is what limits the ability of relaxation and the coarse grid correction to complement each other. This is why classical AMG is not applicable to matrices that have oscillatory low eigenvectors, which is the case for the Dirac operator for random configurations of the gauge field. And so classical approaches will not work for, essentially, for the Dirac operator. Another approach for defining interpolation is the well-known smooth aggregation approach, and this was introduced in the early 90s by Marian Brezina, Jan Mandel, and Petra Vanek. Here, the coarse grid, or the coarse, in this setting, the coarse variables are viewed as degrees of freedom and not as a subset of the fine grid. Essentially, based on the graph of the matrix, the degrees of freedom are grouped into just disjoint aggregates, such that these aggregates union form a covering of the original fine level domain. As an example, here I have the 1D Laplacian with homogeneous Dirichlet boundary conditions, where the independent set algorithm uses the tri-diagonal structure of this operator to form aggregates of size 3. And so now each of these aggregates represents a coarse degree of freedom. Once the aggregates are defined and we're given some slow-to-converge error component x that we want to fit with interpolation, the tentative prolongator is completely defined. And we define it in such a way that the columns are orthonormal and such that we essentially carry the fine level error, we represent it exactly on the coarse level. And this gives rise to the tentative interpolation, which has the following form. So what we've done is, according to our aggregates, we've split up the error x by basically partitioning it according to the aggregates that we formed. If we revisit this example that I gave, we know that for the Laplacian, the lowest or smoothest mode is just the sine hump. And so what we do here is we break the sine hump into pieces based on these aggregates. And this gives us three basis functions, which become the columns of the tentative and prolongation operator. A key point to note here is essentially that although this error is smooth on the fine level, these basis functions are oscillatory. And so in a sense, they'll give a large constant in the stability condition required in the convergence theorem that I discussed, that I presented earlier. And this is precisely the motivation for smooth aggregation, that is, to obtain the final prolongation operator, we smooth the tentative prolongator using some type of Richardson iteration, where tau is essentially selected such that this is an overcorrection. And this is theoretically justified in the literature. Here, rho of A is the spectral radius of the original matrix A, or some approximation to the largest eigenvalue. Okay. Just make a few remarks. The system is rescaled such that the fine level operator has a unit diagonal. This is just due to our choice of a Richardson iteration for smoothing the columns of the tentative prolongator. And, well, I've already said this. Basically, by smoothing the tentative prolongator, we get a better stability constant in the convergence theorem. So now let me motivate the need for adaptive algebraic multi-grid methods. Essentially here, we're thinking of G sub C as being some approximation to the coarse level matrix. And we can think of this as being defined on multiple levels, in which case we have the standard error transfer iteration. Notice this iteration is symmetrized. And so what we see is that the key to the efficiency of such an algorithm is the complementarity of the smoothing process and the coarse grid correction. Each of them must eliminate certain components of the error if the algorithm's to be effective. We choose to fix the smoother, usually it's Gauss-Seidel or overlapping Schwarz. Hence, the sources of potential failure for the above V cycle are either the interpolation error is large, or the coarse grid solver, GC, cannot handle the coarse grid component. And what this means basically is that the interpolation on coarser levels is inefficient, or the error will be large.
Is that the use of the Schwarz there important?
Well, no, these are just for Maxwell's equations, for instance, we would use an overlapping Schwarz to eliminate many of the low frequency modes that are local.
That's
and so
better than Gauss-Seidel.
Much better, but it's also much more expensive, so
well, depending. That's the question. Is it worth it in the end?
Yeah, only if you're solving a problem such as Maxwell's equations would I use such a smoother, I guess. I've used this smoother also for the two-dimensional Dirac operator that I'll discuss later, and that seemed to improve the results, but the CPU times or the run times weren't as good. So in that case, in your context, the answer would be no. So recall that in the classical setting, we choose interpolation to have the following form, and so what we can do to better satisfy the approximation property is either increase the size of the coarse grid or to get better weights for the averaging when we compute the values at the F points using interpolation. Similarly, in smooth aggregation, we select XC such that for the tentative prolongator, we represent the fine level error exactly on the coarse grid. This means that the smooth one will approximately represent this fine level error. Actually, away from boundaries, it'll be true that it still represents it exactly. And so what we see is the need for adapting the multi-grid cycle by selecting additional coarse degrees of freedom or changing interpolation, and therefore changing the coarse level hierarchy. And to guide the adaptation of the base on the basis of a current algebraically smooth error vector X is essentially the main feature or idea behind adaptive algebraic multigrid methods. I'll skip these two slides. This is just some references. So a basic adaptive algebraic multigrid algorithm is described as follows. We just initialize the fine grid problem, and then what we'd like to do is we test the current method, which in the beginning is just relaxation, to see if for a given tolerance, being our target convergence factor, if the method G is good enough. And so essentially, we just, with a random initial guess, we apply the error propagator several times to that random initial guess. If the solver is good enough, we stop and we just start solving the problem. Otherwise, we perform the inner loop, which essentially modifies the hierarchy of coarse problems by changing the interpolation operator. We start by augmenting the column space of the current interpolation to fit this additional component. Since this component came from this iteration and the iteration was slow to converge, we can conclude that this component is not handled well by the current solver. Once we've modified the interpolation operator on the finest level, we form the coarse grid operator using that interpolation operator, and then we go to coarser levels and modify interpolation in a similar way. Finally, once we're done modifying all of the coarse level, the entire hierarchy of coarse levels, we go back to the test, and we now test our new solver to see if it's good enough. And if it isn't, then we repeat this recursively until we've reached some prescribed convergence factor.
So the way you stated this thing, it sounds like you're adding more degrees of freedom to the coarse problem at number one. You said augment?
That's right. This will add degrees of freedom to the coarse problem.
The projection onto the same degrees of freedom, you're actually adding more degrees of freedom.
Right. We can actually improve the projection as well. That may be a first step. So if we compute essentially this iteration and we monitor the Rayleigh quotient of this current error, we can see if the Rayleigh quotient isn't stalling, that we need to first get a better representation for the current of tape interpolation operator. But once the Rayleigh quotient stalls, that tells us that we've done as well as we can on this vector, in which case we should introduce new columns or additional degrees of freedom.
Replacing P with P new rather than adding another.
Exactly, right. So I left that out here, but you would do that first. So I included this slide just essentially to point out one key point, and that's that we use this V-cycle or this multi-level procedure for adapting the hierarchy of coarse problems, not to act, we actually won't use the components that we compute here. But what we're trying to do is, in a true multi-level fashion, get a good approximation to the error that's not eliminated by the current method. And so what we do is we bring that error all the way down to the second to coarsest level, not to the coarsest level, because if we solve this problem exactly, the answer would be zero. And then we get an update. Given this update, we can then run the setup, which gives us a new V-cycle, and then we can test it again. Another observation is that once we have a V-cycle or a hierarchy of coarse problems, instead of applying relaxation, we apply the current V-cycle on every level in order to compute these error components. And so this takes on the following form, which is referred to as a reverse full multigrid cycle, where in order to compute x1, we run a full V cycle on the finest level. To compute x2, we run a V cycle from the second finest level down, etc. So in summary, based on an existing AMG or multigrid code, using adaptation, one improves the solver quality that comes out of the code by changing the solver components one level at a time. And to guarantee improved solver quality after every adaptation step, we need efficient algorithms for building high-quality updates, PNU. And what I'll present next are two algorithms to build interpolation to fit several vectors. This is the multiple vector preserving interpolation algorithm due to Panayot Vasilevsky and Lyudmila Zagatonov, and then the adaptive smooth aggregation algorithm, which was developed by our group in Colorado. So first I'll discuss the multiple vector preserving interpolation algorithm. Essentially, given a current interpolation and an error component x that needs to be additionally fitted by interpolation, we perform the following steps. We compute the interpolation error, that is, we see how well the current interpolation actually fits the additional error component that we want to modify interpolation to fit. We then select additional coarse degrees of freedom and construct a PNU such that this interpolation error is in the range of PNU. And then finally, we augment the interpolation operator by adding PNU into the column space, essentially adding additional degrees of freedom, and we update the coarse grid, or the coarse degrees of freedom, the set of coarse degrees of freedom. So if we assume that the initial interpolation had the following form, which is the case in classical AMG, then the augmented one will have the following form, as I've described here. And so what we're doing essentially is we're building interpolations to fit single vectors and systematically augmenting the interpolation operator. And to fit single vectors, we can use any of the existing methods, for instance, the trace minimization algorithm proposed by Wan, Chen, and Smith, and efficiently implemented by Chu and Zagatonov, or we could use the adaptive AMG approach, which was again proposed by our group in Colorado. So in summary, if interpolation has in its range, the current interpolation has in its range the vectors y1 through ym minus 1, and we want to augment it to fit an additional error component x, then we see that then the augmented one has in its range essentially all of the vectors plus this additional vector. And this is just seen by the fact that E is in the range of P nu, and we can write X in the following form. Also, the resulting interpolation operator or matrix has the following unit triangular form. And so what we see is that essentially this is a full rank operator. This is important because if we have some columns in this interpolation operator that are nearly linearly dependent, then when we form the coarse grid operator, we can introduce additional, or what I'd call spurious near null space components. That is, we make the problem more singular on coarser and coarser levels. In the adaptive smooth aggregation framework, building a tentative and prolongation operator to fit several vectors is trivial. That is, we just break up these additional vectors in the same way that we broke up the single vector by using the aggregates.
A naive question which shows that I haven't followed very well. Suppose you don't want to solve one system, AX equals B, but many systems with many right-hand sides.
Uh-huh.
then your adaptive strategy needs to be done only once.
That's right.
The matrix A.
Yes. So once you have the solver, then you can apply it to any many right-hand sides. And in fact, I won't have time to discuss this today, but we're considering developing a technique where we can update, let's say, delta functions as right-hand sides very fast without even applying the global solver, but just doing some local processing. And so this is directly related to computing the determinant and, of course, the inverse of the Dirac operator, which in this multi-level framework, I would claim can be done very efficiently. So, if we recall, we need to form the tentative interpolation operator such that the columns are orthonormal, and we also want to carry the fine-level error components down to the coarse level, or represent them exactly on the coarse level. And so we can do this using a QR algorithm. Essentially, since these blocks are disjoint, we can apply QR to each of these blocks and then glue the solution together to get Q and R, where here Q gives the interpolation operator and R gives the coarse grid representation of these error components. Okay, and so now just to demonstrate the effectiveness of our approach, I'll consider the application that I've discussed earlier, which is the 2D Wilson formulation, essentially the Hermitian Dirac-Wilson operator. It's defined here by its action on the fermionic field at lattice site X, where here sigma, of course, are the Pauli matrices. These are the covariant difference operators. And these U's here are the so-called gauge field. Of course, the gauge field is given by e to the I theta, where the phase theta is generated via Monte Carlo. And for the numerical examples I'll give, these phases were given to me by Rich. I've rewritten the system here as a two by two block structure, just so I can make some relations to classical PDE type problems. So essentially, if we reorder the equations such that the unknowns corresponding to the first spin indice come first, then we get the following 2x2 block structure. And again, for the tests I'll consider, we're thinking of the right-hand side as being a delta function, that is, it's 1 at a given lattice site and 0 everywhere else. So the operators A and B can be defined by their actions on the fermionic field at lattice site 0, and what we see essentially is that these discrete equations couple the nearest neighbors in the following way. So I've included the term H here, even though in practice this would be equal to 1, and we think of the domain as growing, or the volume is growing as we increase the problem size, because if we rescale the problem such that H goes to 0 on a fixed domain, we let the quark mass be equal to 0, and we think of the free case where the U's are identically 1, then we see that this is just our favorite 5-point Laplacian discretization obtained using second-order central differences. And similarly, this just becomes second-order differences that approximate first-order partial derivatives. So let me just discuss some of the interesting features of the free case in terms of multigrid and solvers. Of course, here U's identically 1, and we can show in Fourier space that the analytic representation of the eigenvalues of the Hermitian operator are given as follows. Here C and S are just the cosine and the sine. The consequences of this is that H is indefinite, which implies we have to solve the normal equations if we're going to use a multigrid approach. And since it's Hermitian, I'll just refer to this as the H-squared system. More importantly, as rho goes to 0, the minimum eigenvalue goes to 0. And in practice, an interesting case is when the mass essentially, well, is equal to order 1 over n. What we really want here, from what I understand, is we want the mass gap to go to 0 for a given system of equations, whether or not it's for the free case or for the general case. And so we say that H and H squared are ill-conditioned, and CG will be very inefficient as a standalone solver. Also, the H squared system becomes a 2 by 2 block decoupled system, which has the following form. And if we rescale the system now such that the grid spacing goes, or the lattice spacing goes to 0 on a fixed domain, then we can write these diagonal blocks in terms of delta H, which is the 5-point Laplacian obtained by second-order central differencing. So what we see is for small mass, or for rho much less than 1, that these are the terms that dominate. And so this behaves very much like a second-order PDE, because this fourth-order term here is multiplied by an h-squared term in the numerator. Moreover, for the quark mass equal to 0, or for rho equal to 0, we have the constant in the null space of these diagonal blocks, and this is the exact representation for these blocks where we factored out the 5-point Laplacian. What we see then is that C is spectrally equivalent to the Laplacian, and so by the theory of equivalent preconditioning, standard multigrid should be an effective preconditioner for the free case. I've demonstrated this here in the following table, where I've given iteration counts to reduce the relative residual by 10 to the 10th for various solvers applied to the H squared system. And what we see is that the algebraic multigrid and the preconditioned algebraic multigrid method behave exactly how as we would expect, that is, they scale with respect to the problem size. Here, this is just diagonally preconditioned conjugate gradient method, and of course, this doesn't scale with respect to the problem size. I should mention I used the Hyper software package, or the High Performance Preconditioners software package that's maintained and developed originally by the Center for Applied and Scientific Computing at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab. And for the AMG cycles, we're using one pre-smoothing and one post-smoothing with a Gauss-Seidel smoother. Of course, the more interesting case is the general case when the gauge field is random. And so I'll make some observations here that and relate the general case to the free case, which should indicate that a good multigrid method can effectively handle this problem as well. So what we have here is we have a plot of the spectrum of H, which is given in red, and of H squared given in green for the free case. And then similarly, for a random configuration of the gauge field, we have a plot of the spectrum of H and H squared. Again, H squared is ill-conditioned, and so we can expect that conjugate gradients will be inefficient as a standalone solver. However, the smooth smoke profiles of the spectra for the random configuration is similar to the free case, which implies that multigrid should be a suitable preconditioner. The one caveat that we have to keep in mind when designing a multigrid algorithm for these types of problems is that the smooth error, or the error corresponding to minimal eigenvalues, is no longer geometrically smooth. And this violates, essentially, the assumptions in the classical algebraic multigrid algorithm, which were that the errors are locally constant. And so what we'll need to do, essentially, is use an adaptive approach to handle the more general case where the gauge field is random. So I'll just give some preliminary numerical results. Again, we're interested in solving the H squared system, or the normal equations. Instead, I've rewritten this complex system as a 2 by 2 real system. This doesn't change the character of the eigenvalues or the eigenfunctions. It's just for practical purposes, because the solver we currently have assumes real data. The solver I've used for these experiments are the smooth aggregation multi-level iterative solver originally developed by Mario Brezina and our group. And here I'm using V22 cycles and a Gauss-Seidel smoother. So here, for a moderate mass gap, what I've done is I've plotted the number of iterations versus log base 10 of the relative residual, just to show that, in fact, our adaptive procedures, or our adaptive algorithms, are suitable preconditioners for this problem. And so what we see here is that, essentially, we reduce the number of iterations needed to solve the problem by an order of magnitude. Here, beta is equal to 3, n is equal to 64. And this is for the gauge field that Rich supplied us with. Of course, number of iterations isn't the whole picture. What we'd really like to know, and this answers your question, is, well, how long does it take for our solver, when compared to CG, to solve this problem for multiple right-hand sides, which is the application that we have in mind. And so what this figure shows, basically, is the CPU time versus the number of right-hand sides, including the setup of the adaptive algorithm. And so what we see is that we need to solve approximately 4 right-hand sides in order to break even, and once we've done that, then our solver will gain significantly in terms of CPU times. Essentially, each one of these solves takes about 4.5 seconds, and each one of these solves, given the setup, takes about 0.8 seconds. This is just using my laptop, so... Yeah, it's a small problem, that's right. So, but it demonstrates the fact that we're appropriately handling the oscillatory modes. That is, we're getting a scalable solver in terms of multigrid
pre. You could also suppress these oscillatory modes by starting by gate fixing.
Right, which is something we've discussed, but
this is a gate invariant prescription because it uses gauge covariant operators to define the projections. So it makes no difference whatsoever what gauge you're in. This is smoothing the true noise, the frustration, the curvature of the field. It's nothing to do with gauge fixing.
But
it's very important that this is true of the old, not totally successful, but nonetheless the gauge invariant methods that Claudio and I did 15 years ago. You want to have a gauge covariant method. As soon as you use the gauge covariant operators to define the projection, which is what we get on local blocks, then it doesn't matter what gauge you're in.
I couldn't follow how gauge symmetry was preserved in this projection.
Well, because he's using the operator itself through this smoothing thing to define the smooth modes. That operator is, in other words, eigenvectors are all these gauge covariant. That's one way to think about it. Instead of finding low eigenvectors. Anyway, it's gauge covariant, doesn't matter.
Is that a property that you require? Or that
no, it comes automatically from the process.
You could always fix the gauge and then do something that wasn't gauge covariant, and then it would be gauge invariant by virtue of fixing the gauge.
Right.
So, I mean, this is a very...
So the last plot I'll give here is just, I think, the most interesting, which shows for various values of beta. Now, I've generated these configurations myself, that the solver really scales with respect to the mass gap. That is, as the problem becomes more and more singular, we see no degradation in the performance of the overall solver. And this is one feature that I believe the existing algorithms, all of the approaches, still suffer from, is I guess what's referred to as critical slowing down. And we see that our solver essentially, is immune to the size of the mass gap, and it's not affected in that fashion. And so this is essentially for preconditioned conjugate gradients with adaptive smooth aggregation as the preconditioner. Again, on a 64, with 64 latticites in each spatial direction. So I'll just conclude by saying that several difficulties must be addressed in designing an AMG for the Wilson fermion matrix or for the Dirac operator. And I'll claim that our adaptive AMG methodology appropriately handles these difficulties. That is, the adaptive setup is designed to expose these oscillatory low modes for the random gauge configurations, and the construction of the sequence of course problems is based on these computed low energy modes. We've demonstrated scalable results for the 2D model over a wide range of parameters, and it remains to be seen if our success for the 2D model carries over to the 4D setting. Actually, I have some preliminary results for the four-dimensional setting that suggest with a slight modification to the coarsening strategy, we'll get, I think, exactly the same results for the four-dimensional problem. And so, Well, I can get the issue with the four-dimensional problem is that there are many non-zeros per row, and then we form this 2x2 real system, which increases the number of non-zeros per row. And then the independent set algorithms that we use to define the coarse degrees of freedom, we use the sparsity graph of the matrix. This implies that we coarsen very aggressively, too aggressively for the four-dimensional problem without considering some additional information. However, I can still, even for this four-dimensional problem, maintain similar results if I do extra smoothing. That is, if I get error that's smooth enough for the coarsening. And essentially what happens if you coarsen so aggressively, in effect what you're doing is you're skipping many levels. And so you need a better representation of the error component at a very coarse level. In fact, I tried a problem from the matrix market with 3,000 or so degrees of freedom, and I wound up with my first coarse level having approximately 10 degrees of freedom, and that's just much too aggressive. And so what we really would need to do is have control over the discretization for the four-dimensional problem so that we can coarsen space independently, for instance.
And all this stuff is, you can't just reformulate it for permission, complex symmetric, whatever you call it, permission, self-adjoint matrices rather than really symmetric matrices. Not do this AB minus BA to it, which you find all the variable analysis.
No, there's ways to do this. My only intent.
But the entire philosophy,
sure,
from the beginning.
Sure.
It's
just a matter of code. The only thing I'm trying to illustrate here is that I believe these adaptive methods appropriately handle this problem and that this should be seriously considered.
Change in the way you define your course and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean that has no sort of, it doesn't depend on the fact that it's in clear.
No. No, no. So we could even handle the well.
You see, the reason I'm asking is that very naively, the zeros that are in the complex matrix are more zero than the zeros in the real matrix because they are zero real, zero imaginary.
The storage is essentially doubled, as is the runtime. But developing
intuitively, when you think about chasing after zeros, zero entries.
Yeah.
Sort of carries the information of the sparsity.
Sure.
If you think complex, the zeros are complex. When you think real, the zeros are real.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, it's very. So it doesn't matter. I'm asking.
No, it doesn't matter. That's right.
I see. There's nothing to be gained to go back to scratch from the beginning and say, I'm doing the entire philosophy, I'm buying it. But I just want to think all the time about permission matrices. All I buy is a factor of two storage. That's it.
And computation as well. So there's
computation.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, just in computation because
it's twice as many operations if you go through and
but
analyze it. No, everything will hold in the same way. In fact, by splitting it into a real 2x2 system, we're handling the low modes and the eigenvalues in exactly the same way. It just splits them up into their real and complex part. So the algorithm really should work.
I don't think that's the question. I mean, you're splitting it in real, that's just a data representation, no effect whatsoever. The question
is practically.
No, that's just a coding thing, it's got nothing to do with it. But the thing that doesn't, it is an issue, is that you're using ADAG array.
Sure, so you mean the normal equation. Right.
So I asked the same question that we did on Monday. So I can tell you how I understood it. You can tell me whether I understood
sure.
it.
Sure.
Okay. That will, because he's using the normal equations to find the low eigenvalues. So they are low eigenvalues of the normal equations, not low eigenvalues of the operator itself. Now, of course, if you use the Hermitian operator, it's the same thing, just square. Okay, so that's all right. And then it turns out, so I think your sensitive answer was right, example. Then it turns out that it doesn't matter when you do the projection before or after you square it. Because of the orthogonality condition and this Galerkin form he has of using projections and elongations as transposes
right.
to each other, it actually, you could just rephrase it as having defined the coarse operator for H not H squared. So it doesn't affect, I think, the machinery at all, I believe.
Right.
Yeah, right?
Right. We could even
except for you double the its eigenvalues that change in sign would be a single eigenvalue on each square.
Sure.
In some small difference, but it wouldn't change it very much. But of course, then the question is whether the iteration would be better. Now, when we did this, as I say, in the old tape, we actually didn't use the normal equations. And so I personally, don't think it's necessary.
Again, I would say that there are many things that I think can be, less general and should be designed specifically for this problem at hand. And again, my only point is just to demonstrate that the methodology is appropriate. Designing the algorithm will require physical insight.
Sure.
And so I think it can be much simpler.
The problems which are inherently complex is not small. Only us.
Yes, yes.
Sure.
Even notice us, I'm sorry.
So there aren't very many.
Unless a much larger class of general problems, if you cast all of this into complex.
There's only one code that I know of that is actually complex, a multi-grid code, and that's in a classical setting, which was written by one of the original developers, John Ruge, and that wouldn't handle these types of problems. It would fail just as any classical method would. So, but yes, I think that.
Well, I believe that many people in our field found themselves eventually just by hand translating, getting rid of this AB minus BA and saying, how would I do it directly complex?
Yeah.
Doing it.
Yeah.
That's the way. I think in the numerical analysis, there's lots of software developed for real systems.
Yeah.
And then
that's right.
You look at the properties that you need, and it's positive definiteness, whatever. So the same methods work for complex data, say, but the package is not there.
That's right.
Such a package is not something you would rewrite in a week.
No, this is 15 years of code that's been developed. That's right. So.
But there's a real price you pay in the compiler not being able to understand you have complex arithmetic. You did a much better job on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's
really
pay for it.
I'm confused about the approach of algebraic multigrid, which, as you said, I think looks at the matrix elements. And for instance, if the matrix element is small, then it is removed after projection. The matrix is decimated that way. And how is this notion of algebraic multigrid compatible with gauge covariance, which is a purely geometric concept? You need to know about the locality.
I'm not sure I understand how it relates to that, but we're not actually truncating the operator in a sense. We're just defining interpolation and then as a result getting a new operator. In terms of the covariance, I'm not sure how it affects that. I guess I don't know how to answer this question.
If a matrix element is small in one gauge, it's not small in another gauge.
No, that's not true. what you're doing here basically is you're looking for, let's think of them as essentially eigenvectors across the whole system. They're not quite, it's just sort of relaxing and cooling the thing down so it gets into the space which is close to the subspace spanned by small eigenvectors, okay? Now, if you have an operator which is covariant, gauge covariant, and you operate on a state, the whole point of gauge invariance, if you change the operator by a gauge transformation and you change the state, the fermion field, by the same gauge transformation, it's the same process. You just, notice it, right? And so every single step in the code is doing that. So you will not notice if you change the gauge before and then change it back out.
I understand that. I'm just surprised that it's compatible with an algebraic philosophy which doesn't look at the geometry.
No, that's right. Look, so the earlier algebraic philosophy.
So it's still called algebraic.
The early algebraic philosophy, which you described, maybe you should, was to look sort of at the strength and the magnitude of the connections. This is letting the operator itself define by
the process,
by its application, what you mean by algebraic. So this is much more.
It's not a predefined notion of what the eigenvectors are, for instance.
That's what he gave you. He told you how you would do it. It was simple, and all of the numbers were basically positive, but they varied.
For M matrices, for instance, where we really get geometrically smooth functions. But clearly, we don't have that here. And so.
So when you increase the lattice N,
that is pointing in each direction. You will get more, I would think, non-smooth, no eigennodes. So the algebraic multigrid would have to adapt itself to more.
This depends on how well, when you break these pieces up, these pieces form a basis for all of the low modes. So it's not clear to me. From what I understand, a lot of these low modes are fairly local. They're not completely global, not completely local.
Right.
And so as you increase the domain, if we go back to this picture, this isn't a single low mode, but this is a representation, would be my guess, of a whole ensemble of low modes, global representation. So what I would guess is that the number of vectors should stay relatively fixed as we increase the size of the domain, because the global size of this vector increases with the size of the domain as well. And so the key, of course, as you said, is that we can use a relatively small number of vectors to represent all the ones that are left after relaxation. If we can't do that, this will lead to a dense operator on coarser levels and an inefficient method. So,
So the point would be that you could represent all the low eigennodes by
some basis which we obtain.
Right.
And that's what makes this efficient. Otherwise, eventually, this just becomes a direct solve, in a sense, because as we fit more and more vectors, P becomes dense, the interpolation operator, and so does the coarse grid operator. So, but that's an important point that we need to study still. I have looked at problems where we've generated the gauge variables using Gaussian distribution instead of Monte Carlo process, because that was the problem that was originally presented to us. And for those problems, things completely scale with the problem size. The reason I haven't done it for the Monte Carlo is just because I haven't had the data. And it's very time consuming, at least in a naive way, to compute these gauge fields. So.